How concerned do we need to be about the emerging flu?
Looking at a diabetes report card.
Do we finally have a handle on the increasing rate of autism?
And preventing worm infections in Chinese school children.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on April 26th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, we're going to have three studies actually this week from the New England Journal of Medicine. So why don't we start with the one I'm not familiar with, and that's the one on worms in China, in Chinese school children, the worm burden and what we can do about it.
A third of the global population, and that's mainly in developing countries, is infected with soil-transmitted worms, or we call them helminths. These are intestinal parasites. There are about 1 billion infections with roundworms, about 600 million infections with whipworms, and 800 million persons are infected with hookworms. About half of the global disease burden falls to children between the ages of 5 to 14, and we know that these parasitic infections can contribute to poor mental and physical development. Since about 8 to 10% of the population in these developing countries has a parasitic infection, treatment is just to give mass drugs to clear the infection. The unfortunate thing is they can get reinfected. So if you look at these individuals 12 and 18 months later, a huge number develop reinfection. So this was a study looking at health education delivered to fourth and fifth graders in Chinese schools to determine if they could actually prevent reinfection of students that had been treated with mass administration of drugs. They took 38 schools, 19 of which were just controlled, and the other half actually had a health education program, a 12-minute cartoon video, classroom instruction. They had them draw pictures just to prove that they got the concept. And what they discovered was that this health education package was effective in reducing reinfection by 50%.
How onerous is this education effort, and how difficult is it for school children to implement the changes that are suggested?
It was extremely easy and low cost. At baseline, only 50% of the kids washed their hands after going to the bathroom. After this education, 99% of the kids did. Now, in fairness, it was culturally relevant. They engaged community leaders and educators to develop a product that was interesting and applicable and relevant to them. But this is very easy to apply really across the spectrum, no matter what culture you're looking at.
Good news then. Let's hope that this is implemented throughout China and other places in the developing world. Elsewhere in the New England Journal of Medicine this week, let's take a look at the diabetes report card for the last decade.
We are both aware that diabetes is becoming an increasing problem, especially associated with the increase in obesity, both in adults and in children. But over the last decade, from 1999 to 2010, we've had several national programs that allow us to track the progress in meeting the goals with regard to diabetes and decreasing the other risk factors. So this is an analysis of data for adults that have diabetes from both the National Health and Nutrition Exam Survey and the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. What they discovered was from 1999 through 2010, there was some modest successes. The percentage of individuals that were reaching the goal, hemoglobin A1C, an assessment of how well they were controlling their diabetes, increased from 44% to 52%. With regard to control of the LDL cholesterol, that increased from 36 to 56%. With regard to blood pressure, from about 40 to 50%. But interestingly enough, there was no gain at all in terms of preventing smoking. Still a fourth of individuals did. Although there were some modest gains, about one-third to one-half of all the participants were not meeting their goals. About 22% still smoked, and only 14% met the targets for all four risk factors. So although there were modest improvements, Elizabeth, we still got a long way to go.
Well, I think that's really good job security for some of us. And also, this sure sounds like to me, are we going to view this glass as half full or half empty? And from the half full perspective, I would have to say that clearly this is pointing us in the direction of interventions that seem to be having an impact.
They do have an impact. Unfortunately, the absolute number of individuals developing diabetes is increasing. So these modest gains are really damped down.
I would then devolve back to the idea that, of course, the underpinnings of all of this should be prevention. That would be avoiding weight gain, maintaining a lot of mobility and exercise, and dietary changes.
Yep, I would agree with all that. The other thing that this data directs us to is if you look at the one group that really didn't have any significant improvements, it was the younger individuals. So we've got a lot to do, and particularly with targeting younger individuals with the importance of first trying to prevent it. But if you have it, let's at least try to get to goal.
Okay. Finally, let's complete our triumvirate then from the New England Journal of Medicine this week and take a look at H7N9, the flu strain that has emerged actually in China, what they have to say about that.
The first cases of this influenza A, as you call the H7N9 viral infection, was first reported in humans in China during February and March of 2013. This is a preliminary report describing the epidemiology and the characteristics. The average age of individuals was 63, but patients as young as 2 years and as old as 89 years had contracted the infection. Most of these individuals actually lived in urban centers, and about three-fourths of them were male. 21% of people who contracted this have died, but of the 82 persons, 60 still remain in critical condition, so it's likely that the mortality rate is going to actually go up. Most of these individuals had contact with poultry in some way or another. Concerning, there were two possible cases of human-to-human transmission. The other things we know about this H7 infection is it doesn't respond to amantadine. It requires Tamiflu or Relenza, that is a neuraminidase inhibitors. The incubation time is about 6 days, and the time from when patients first experience symptoms to death is about 11 days. What else do you think our listeners should know about this?
One of the things I think is interesting is that the CDC has just released this week recommendations regarding management of H7N9. Talks about the use of neuraminidase inhibitors even 48 hours after someone has become symptomatic, in contrast to how we normally manage antivirals in people who have the flu or supposedly have the flu. So I think that that expanded window is telling. It says, hey, we're really concerned about this.
What's clear is that the earlier the treatment is initiated, the more likely it is to be effective. But you're right, when you have diseases that are this serious and carry such a high mortality, we're extending the treatment time.
The other thing that's interesting about this is that there is a vaccine that was developed by molecular biology means. So I feel very hopeful that by the time this thing starts to make its way across the globe, we're going to have something that's effective.
But it will take several months. And so key right now is surveillance, identifying individuals that have it, isolating them as quickly as possible. This is probably just the tip of the iceberg. We've identified those that are sickest. There's some concern that there actually may be people with very mild disease. And more importantly, that the poultry and perhaps the pigs that are infected with this really don't exhibit much in the way of symptoms.
And I guess for right now, let's just leave people with the idea that if they're traveling to Asia or to China specifically, they should be very vigilant about precautions.
Absolutely. And we have ways in the U.S. of testing whether someone has developed an infection.
Excellent. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. I served it up as, wow, do we finally have a smoking gun with regard to the increasing rate of autism? Could that be valproate during pregnancy?
Valproate, which is one of the anti-epileptic or anti-seizure medications, is known to cause many congenital abnormalities. Despite that, there are about 8 million prescriptions written for valproate between 2005 and 2007, just for girls and women aged 15 to 44 years. Only about 900,000 of these were written for its use as an anti-seizure medication. It's also used for bipolar disease and for pain. There have also been studies that show that IQs on average were lower in children that had been exposed to valproate in utero. This particular study shows that the use of valproate during pregnancy is also associated with the development of autism and autism spectrum disorders. So examining over 655,000 children born from 1996 to 2006, they identified over 5,000 with autism spectrum disorder and over 2,000 with frank autism. Those children who were exposed to valproate were 2.5 to 4 times more likely to develop these disorders than the general population. We've not been able to identify a lot of causes of autism. It looks like this is perhaps one of them, and a significant one, I might add.
I think it's great that we could finally pinpoint something that might be responsible for this apparent increase in autism, and clearly something that has a reasonable intervention associated with it.
a large number of women of childbearing age are receiving valproate. And there are other effective medications for bipolar disease or for pain control. And since half of all pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, that means women that are taking valproate don't plan to become pregnant, but do and expose their children to this risk. They just need to be aware that it's a possibility and there are other alternatives.
Excellent. So this week on the blog, I'm going to do H7N9. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.